that's a really good point, because you know, it's really, I think for designers to become independent and like walk the path of independence and like be a one-man business or like a one-woman business or like a pair or a collective of design teams, they need to have arrived at a healthy level of self-awareness about who they are, what they want to do, what kind of impact they would like to create in this world, how do they see themselves, what kind of clients they would like to work with, what kind of industries, right? And without this healthy dose of self-awareness, I think designers would have difficulty thriving in this free market.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot of people that sometimes say like, well, you know, I'll now freelance for a bit and then I'll do this and then I'll do that. So I think there's like people for whom design, like freelancing is a transition and it's just like, you know, the means to like their next job or the next thing that they want to do.
Bonanza Growth Podcast, innovation, strategy, and UX for SaaS. Bonanza Studios is a growth consultancy for SaaS and fintech startups. Every SaaS business needs to fight in three different battles. First, product market fit, discovering a growing marketing and designing a compelling and undeniable solution to meet that demand. Second, product-led growth, turning your product into a growth vehicle by leveraging outcome-driven UX design. And third, creative marketing and organic brand building. If you're looking for a reliable partner to drive growth, check out our website at bonanza-studios.com.
Yeah, so, yeah. Finally, we made it, huh?
Yes, took a couple of months.
Yeah, took a couple of months. Hey, Damien, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah,
I think it's a great pleasure to have you in Berlin, so to speak. I think.
Yeah.
Berlin. I don't know what happened to Berlin, but Berlin wasn't the same after the pandemic. Lockdowns were over. Maybe you want to talk about it a bit on that.
I completely agree with you. There was definitely a before and after. I think in a lot of ways the tech world and the tech scene has drastically changed. But for Berlin, as particularly, I guess you're talking about meetups and events and this kind of stuff, it really felt like it made a huge stop and no one was really interested in coming back before we did with the product design meetups.
And you took the opportunity, I think before pandemic, we were holding webinars and workshops. There were a lot of other events and conferences. There were at least a couple of conferences about design for sure. I attended one actually years ago, but all of a sudden, Hatch Conference cropped up out of nowhere. And I gotta say, I wasn't there, but from whatever content that was about the first edition that I saw on LinkedIn and Twitter, it was a very decent experience. Yeah, that was a big surprise for me, and then sort of like got my curiosity who's behind it. And you took a really good opportunity when there was a big gap in the market. You entered with a very strong product.
Yeah, it was definitely the right time to do it, and the effort for the first one was kind of that it happened before everything else. Obviously, put a lot of work into making it as good as one could with all the restrictions that we had. We started planning in January 2021 while Germany still had lockdown and restrictions of meeting indoors. People were talking about that it was going to be like up to like 150 to 200 maximum. So with those numbers in our head, we started thinking of like, okay, what can we do with it? So our goal was to make it as relevant as possible, and particularly that it happens no matter what the laws and the situation got into in like 9 months from then, which was like crazy to think so much in advance.
I really want to like get into it, because it's for a lot of designers listen to this, and a lot of designers stay as designers, and I mean, they don't think about diversification or like leveling up and like like they don't think about entrepreneurship as a bet for their future mm-hmm. career. But I think you sort of like a good example of a design entrepreneur that liked the idea of like trying new things, especially tapping to the business side of equation, so to speak. So so you were thinking about launching a conference while it was locked down, or you had the idea before? Can you like walk me through the timeline?
Yeah, so it all started in I was saying January 2021. It was actually January 2022. But what I meant is in 2021, we started, me and a friend started meetups in Berlin for product designers, because none of the big groups were coming back
dinosaurs.
Exactly. No, yeah. And what we did at the beginning was like, we reached to all these big meetups that used to happen. And we were like, hey, we're offering our time. We want to volunteer and help out, bring this back. What can we do? And we had conversations with some of the people who were making them, and they were all like, yeah, we're not sure, it's maybe too early, or we, you know, or our team has now like completely split and we're not sure how to get started again. So we decided to start our own, and we did our first one was at Red Sofa's offices. It was like a, you know, kind of like a store type of office, and we had like inside and outside, like everything open for ventilation, masks and tests and all this kinds of stuff. Ready, but it happened and people were super happy. And then they continued to grow for a couple of months. And I remember in one of them, one of our sponsors came and was like, hey, have you considered just doing this in a larger scale? Because Berlin doesn't really have a design conference. And I was like, this cannot be true. Like, there has to be like a UX or design conference in Berlin. And I started looking and there wasn't. And this sort of like, I said, all right, I guess this is definitely an opportunity. And then basically from December 2021, January 2022 is when the planning started, with everything from having to find a venue, which was obviously the first thing to make it happen. Not as easy, even in pandemic times. There were already, you know, a lot of places that were booked, obviously not cheap. So it was about crunching the numbers. And I sort of trusted that the community and, you know, the people that I knew were gonna be excited about the idea and pay for a ticket.
Yeah, that's wow. Yeah, I'm curious. So you are a designer at heart.
Yes,
right.
Stuck.
Yeah. And now you are sort of like wrestling in the business field and dealing with numbers and typical revenue to cost ratio and booking and marketing. That you have a brand, I leave it up to you to announce the new hatch. I mean, I know that there are a couple of really good speakers are coming in. So mm-hmm. you are basically in the trenches, scaling an operation, scaling a business. How did this impact you as a designer?
I'm a designer by training. I think my path to starting to freelance was always to realize, hey, I can actually do things that I like more and make more money by freelancing. And from then on, it sort of always started to be a lot about kind of the return on investment of what I was doing. But I was very lucky to always work in kind of like smaller teams and small startups. I had a small agency for like 2 years. I also worked with small companies of like, you know, no more than 5 people in the company. And I went through like Techstars with one of these companies in 2020, exactly before the pandemic started. And all of these experiences sort of really led me to understand the other side of the business that doesn't have to do too much with the design output, but actually with what makes a business feasible. And I always wanted to do something of my own in that terms. And I actually have been. I have a separate business that's a completely unrelated thing. It's a business for Shopify merchants in Germany. It has nothing to do with design, but a lot of events and stuff as well happening there, which sort of completed the other part that I needed to launch something like that. And yes, there's a lot of, I think, being an entrepreneur, you're always uncomfortable in a lot of roles that you have to have. I didn't know how to do a lot of things that I had to do for hatch number one and I'm doing for hatch number two. But with time comes the confidence, and obviously with the support of a lot of people who are involved one way or another.
So when did you go freelancing? So at which point in your career, you were like, look, it's just walk me through that, because I sort of like our sort of path journey so somehow similar, and a very good portion of this audience, our audience, they are basic up and coming designers, right? Walk me through like your journey, if you can go as much as possible back in your journey, like starting probably as a full-time employee. What happens, like what kind of like, you know, what happens in the way that you started thinking about freelancing, and when did you go freelancing? Just get into the detail a bit.
I started as a graphic designer. That's what I studied, and I was my first job was with a company which was like importing computer. I'm originally from Buenos Aires, by the way, and this is where I was working. And I started working at like, I don't know, what was I, like 22 or something like that. Yeah, I think 22, at a company which was importing this computers for gamers, like, but just the chassis and just like sort of rebranding them and putting them out there. So we were doing like catalogs, but also some websites and stuff like that. I mean, the first jobs that I had were just like plain like graphic design jobs, and a lot of stuff had to do still with prints and doing things like this. I also worked for a really cool like studio that was also doing like motion graphics and things like that. But I always had this interest for like tech, and you know, this was like in the beginnings of like everything that had to do with UX, or even a step before, you know, when the third iPhone launched and really like the app stores were really starting to become a thing. I was always interested in that, and I always wanted to like try to do, you know, apps and things in the digital space. Well, most of my colleagues were all like, you know, designers on the print side, and they wanted to do like books and illustrations. I was like coding websites and doing like WordPress blogs and things like this, for a living. And at one point it came to be that all these side gigs that I was doing, as part of my job, were making a lot more money than my full-time job, or like my semi full-time job. So at this point, I was like, you know, I really liked the people that I was working with, and the studio was fantastic. But I was like, listen, like I'm making a lot more money just like doing this for my house, and it just gives me the freedom to do other stuff. So that's where I basically stopped full-time work. I was maybe like 23, 24, and then I moved to Germany. And here I started working full time for Kayak, and then for other companies. I think I worked around like 3 years and a half, and having had a taste of like what freedom is, and what it is to kind of be able to pick your own projects. Also being someone who likes to work on different things at the same time and not just on one product for a very long time. It was the right thing to do. And after I finished one job, I took some sabbatical, and then I started freelancing again, and sort of never looked back.
Yeah, so let's get a bit deeper. I mean, both of us have gone through a freelancing phase, and of course, if you get it right, you can make more money. But you know, it's that's just the happy side of freelancing. Talk to me about a bit like, you know, the 360 degree view on freelancing, because it's a lot of work. Like that, a lot of designers, I've seen designers that are like, oh yeah, I'm going to go freelancing. I'm going to work from the beach. You know, I'm going to have cocktail while looking at my laptop and writing, pushing pixels. I was like, okay, that's just not true.
No. Huh. I think the hard part of freelancing is, I mean, it depends, right? Like freelancing can just be like working in longer term projects, but just being a contractor, which sort of obviously you don't have the security, but at the same time you have the freedom of being like, I'm not doing this next month, bye. Which has, you know, for some people it's great, for some people it's terrible. I think it's hard when you're a freelancer and you have to like constantly be looking for new customers, because obviously that doesn't happen as easy. I think I was very lucky because all my customers have kind of came as word of mouth and just recommended and stuff like that. I think I've kind of applied for freelance gig just two times in my life or something like this, and that's also why, you know, the network is very important, and I think that's what's really given me a lot of what I have right now. But obviously, yeah, the part about freelancing that it's not for everyone is that you really need to learn to be an organized person. You really need to deal with customers and go through things that are really hard to do. I'm a very ethical person when it comes to work, and I've had situations where I really was paralyzed and didn't know what to do. People not paying, people claiming that they, you know, they had something else. So then with all these kind of like mistakes, you learn to really like draft everything and writing and going through all these processes, which obviously you're not charging for, but it assures you that the work is going to be done the way you want. And obviously at one point you might realize that you need to charge a little more because you're really working much more than you thought. As I mentioned before, I also started an agency with a friend who was a developer, and we were doing like MVP Foundry kind of thing. And ideally it was great, but just to deal with all the other stuff that had to do with the business just drained us. And then we didn't have really even time to do the work that we actually wanted to do, which was just like getting to the code and getting to the design. Freelancing can be really liberating, but it also comes with a lot of responsibility. And if you're just happier doing the work and getting paid for it, then you should not do it.
You know, something that you mentioned, I sort of like picked up on it, and I think it's a very important characteristic asset for a designer, mm-hmm. is discipline, right? Yep. Especially I see this stark difference between freelancers or self-employed designers and these folks that, you know, been sort of hopping from one full-time gig to another full-time gig, that it's not a generalized rule, but based on my experience, folks that they were freelancers or self-employed, they are more disciplined, more sort of like on top of their own game than folks that I've seen that they've been only full-timing.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's definitely a personality trait on one side, but it's something that you train and that you definitely get better at it as you make mistakes and as you get screwed. There's no other better way to say it. Like a lot of times, obviously, you know, some customers will just take advantage of you not having the right process, yes. in place and leaning that towards what they understand of things. So I think the discipline comes really into having made those mistakes and sometimes just thinking the best of people and having gotten a little disappointed by some stuff. But I think everyone who's in business understands that and respects that, and they're not going to be angry that you don't want to start working before you set things, you know, on paper or before you clear the conditions, because I think eventually transparency saves time. Mm-hmm. And then if it's not the right thing for either of you, then it's fine. Then you don't do it. But at least you saved yourself from like a longer, harder pain.
Yeah, I agree. 100%. I think being disciplined about your process, what you believe in, your norms, your rules, how you want to work, who you want to work. There are sometimes, you know, I've myself was in those situations that I essentially worked with the wrong people. Not that, you know, they were bad people. They're just like, mm-hmm. they were not a yeah. match. That's why there is a market for UX design services. Not every client can work with me. There has to be a lot of match. There are different factors involved in a client choose you instead of someone else. One of the main aspects is whether you guys can work together, whether you guys can have an easy conversation. That because at the heart of a great design lies conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's something about, as you say, at one point when you get the privilege to be able to choose who your customers are, you also have to be aware of who you can work with better or who you can bring the most value, right? So mm-hmm. I think to me at this point, I mostly work with people who are not as technical and especially don't have the resources to like set up a team and have everything running. So they want someone who understands sort of the everything that, you know, the debt that they have and how much the costs and the terms of building something is beyond just like doing the designs and the screens, so that they can be sure that it's feasible and that's easy to implement. If I were to go into a team that has, like, you know, already like five designers working there and all these processes, and I would be just one part of the chain, I don't think my value would be as much there and probably would not work. So yeah. I would say no to those kind of opportunities.
That's really cool. That's a really good point, because, you know, it's really, I think for designers to become independent and like walk the path of independence and like be a one-man business or like a one-woman business or like a pair or a collective of design teams, they need to have arrived at a healthy level of self-awareness about who they are, what they want to do, what kind of impact they would like to create in this world, how do they see themselves, what kind of clients they would like to work with, what kind of industries, right? And without this healthy dose of self-awareness, I think designers would have difficulty thriving in this free market.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot of people that sometimes say like, well, you know, I'll now freelance for a bit and then I'll do this and then I'll do that. So I think there's like people for whom design, like freelancing is a transition and it's just like, you know, the means to like their next job or the next thing that they want to do. And that's different than someone who's like, you know, I want to build a business out of this and I want to, you know, to eventually turn this into like a long-term thing, either me becoming a brand or me becoming a studio, you know, as you did, or, you know, any of this kind of paths are very different. To me, it was always more about the possibility of working with different projects and different people and different things. I always felt a little bad when it was like a year and I had just worked on this like three features for a product. Two of them did not get released and something like that. And then I was like, all right, this is great. Like, what do I have to show for my 2013 or something like this? So to me, it was always much more exciting to be like, hey, you know what? Like, if I'm actually updating my portfolio next year, I have like 20 things I did. 10 of them are horrible, but like 8 are kind of okay. And I think like 5 I could show, you know, like things like that. And I think otherwise it would be really hard. And I think as a designer, what, you know, the output says a lot about ourselves. And sometimes we sort of like identify with our outputs. So I think it would be really hard for me to just look at something and be like, you see this little icon here? Like, yeah, we tested like for half a month and then added it. Not to say that that's not something that really adds value to a product. It's just more about what one wants to do with their outcome and their possibilities as a designer.
Like, you know, 100%. You mentioned about portfolio, and I think, you know, portfolio is basically the passport of a designer. With that, you get into certain places, you don't get to certain places.
I mean, and most of us have expired passports.
Yeah, that is true. Mine is so expired. I don't know. I cannot get out of Berlin because I don't have a passport. Yeah. You've been in this game for long, and then you probably have your own unique point of view when it comes to putting together or updating your portfolio. Portfolios is Achilles heels of designers. That's one of the number one, if not the major pain point of designers, is they don't know how to put together a good portfolio. Any thoughts, tips, you know, do's, don'ts, here a mistake I made, you don't make this mistake, to share for our designers?
I think the hardest thing about a portfolio is that you have to make the decision, who is it for? And it's really hard when someone is like, I would just take anything as work, because then it just gets really less specific and it's much tougher. I think I think I've updated my portfolio like 4 or 5 times in my life, but like I think that you know, at least the last time I did it, to me was clear with kind of which kind of companies I want to work with. So what will I actually showcase? And you know, I still have like a strong desire to work in projects that are very visual and that have to do with branding as well and stuff like that. So I want to showcase that. And what I've done, like a lot of work that's like core UX and very like, you know, not very showy, but very interesting and very good work. I would prefer to just show like a very nice dashboard and a very nice process of like you know, for a wizard, I don't know, for lead generation or something like that, that I thought like, oh, this looks really, really good. And still has obviously the components of the other work. It's just less easy to notice. In terms of tips, it's just to try to be specific. Try to imagine which kind of companies or for which kind of customers you want to work with, and try to showcase why you might be better than others, or what your profile really is. Try to avoid trends, because you know you'll have to update your portfolio every 6 months. So try to be like semi aware. Like, you still need to have like a trendy portfolio, but not like completely. You know, there's always certain resources that are repeated over and over again, whether it's like glass morphism or things like that, and then sort of after a year or something, it just looks old. These kind of things are, I think, are key to just like not feel that your portfolio has to be updated so often, because maybe it doesn't really have to.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, really try to sort of like focus on putting achievements in your portfolio that could stand the test of time, focusing on what kind of impact you provided or delivered for the company, rather than here's my shiny icon, because that shiny icon, although it's shiny today, tomorrow it's going to look very, very old.
I think being someone who was originally trained in graphic design, and I've done a lot of editorial, I've always had the advantage that I always really liked the process of doing the portfolio, because I saw it as a piece of editorial, and I would like to do. I mean, I would get very bored of the part of like selection of the the screenshots and doing all that kind of stuff. But as to like think how would I want it to be and to say, and how to do like about you page and this kind of stuff, I would really have always a very fun time, or trying to make like the right the right thumbnails and the right the right images for it. It's always more fun than having to like actually write the case study and actually like tell things about it.
So I want to just while I have you with me, I want you to get your thoughts on another aspect of basically a designer career, which I believe is very important and is often neglected. That is personal branding. Right? By good measures, like, I think what you have taken as a career path is almost an aspirational career path for a designer, like starting as a sort of like working as a full time, doing a lot of here and there, freelancing, having your own businesses, now launching a very successful conference, you are about to hold the second edition of it. So, what is personal branding to you, and how do you leverage it in your work and to grow, to basically to advance your projects?
Yeah. There's this very famous quote that says that branding is what people say when you're not in the room. And I really live by this. And I think for a long time, I always struggle a little bit thinking like, oh, I have to create, kind of like a personal brand or an idea that people will actually, kind of like remember and respect and stuff like that. And that became really like hard to even picture. But when you start doing projects that are close to your heart, and then people start sort of like giving you feedback on that, and then you grow together with that, it just becomes much easier to create your personal branding. I don't think one should start from like, what's my brand going to be like, and develop it from there. I think it's more start like creating projects and things that you really want to do, and then the rest will follow and you'll find the right path. For a long time, I thought like, should I create any kind of specific content? Should I talk about design? I mean, I used to teach design, so to me, it's always been very close to my heart to also share in this kind of way. But I learned particularly that my talent is more the connector kind of personality than the person in the spotlight. And particularly both the meetups and the conference, I feel really, really in my, in my sauce by just having to do this, because I can really find the people who have something to say and give them a platform and sort of like put all of that together and have people that are really grateful about that, without having to be about me or my design skills or my you know, personality or something like that. Obviously, right. It all leaks through, and I end up doing the design for everything that I do. But I think the important part about personal branding is that it's authentic. So it cannot really be like built in a lab, right? It really has to be attached to what your values and your ideas are at the end of the day.
I mean, that's one of my problems with this, like branding workshops or like personal branding workshop that I see presentation on LinkedIn or I've seen folks attending and they basically whip out a chart in Miro or on the whiteboard and they draw three circles, why and what and how, and what's my... I really don't think that kind of approach to achieving or crafting personal branding is useful because, as you said it, and I resonate with that as well, it's like you really cannot engineer personal branding. Personal branding is directly tied or connected to your soul, so to speak. You know, it needs to be a bottom-up approach rather than you cannot reverse engineer it. That's I just don't see how it's possible that you understand your purpose in life or your brand mission in a workshop.
Yeah, I understand that as for everything, there will always be kind of like the quick corporate solution, right? There will always be like a training or a workshop or something. And I do still believe there's probably people who have a lot to teach us about personal branding or you know, or building portfolios or things like that, and that is interesting to hear from, but ultimately there's not like one quick solution, right? I think one has to like get the learnings from other people and the stories and the ways they did it, but then obviously craft their own path. And I don't know if there's like a way to do that in a fast, efficient way all the time. To me, it was always like it was a whole journey of, first of all, trying to understand what kind of designer I want to be. And then once I've sort of reached that, trying to understand also like, what do I want to do with like, you know, the kind of like second act of my life, maybe, and just be like, okay, you know, I've always lived a little bit under this very tough motto of like, you know, who's going to hire a 50-year-old designer to do like, not to be ageist or anything like that. But what I mean is there's always going to be people who need less money and who are going to be much better than you. So at a certain point, you need to like grab those skills and build something on top of that. And I think once you really feel pushed to do it, and when you really are like, okay, like I really need to find my next thing, I think those aspects of your personal brand or things that you can actually put out for yourself become more obvious than when you're younger and just getting started.
No, I think you're speaking truth. Every seasoned designers that are listening to this and they are working for someone else, or they haven't really thought about their own personal branding or their own mission in life, they need to be thinking about this. And I don't want to like, you know, instill fear in you, but I just want to like think about this, that what's your next move? Because exactly as you said it, in similar vein, I had the same thinking or same concerns, in 2018-19, when I was just like slowly thinking about, you know, doing my own shop and like have my own business. I was telling myself, Berat, at some point your hands get slowed down. You are going to have a family. You know, there will be someone come. There will be a younger, more talented designer will come out and that deliver the same thing that you're delivering 10 times better, 10 times cheaper. Right? Because, like, you know, as you grow, your lifestyle is getting more expensive, you know, rightfully so, because, you know, it's why not? I mean, like, if you're, I think everyone deserves to have a good life. And then you cannot really like say, hey, I'm going to charge you that amount of money. The guy was like, hey, I look into Dribbble. There is this talented 20 years old guy from, I don't know, from working from his mom's garage. And they charge me like 1/10 of what you're charging me.
Yeah.
And hey, if it's going to be the output that they are delivering is shiny too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I think at a certain point your personal brand cannot be your skills and just your output, right? it really has to be like, what about working with you instead of with this other guy who's cheaper justifies the extra, not just the extra money, just like, why should I work with you? Even if you both charge the same and you both have the same level of experience or anything, like, why would I choose you instead of someone else? And I guess eventually it has to do a lot with your personality, with your way of working. But it also has to do with the kind of things that you bring to the table that maybe are softer skills or things that are outside your design skills, right? Because at a certain point, I think everyone's just like, no, just because one someone is like 20% better at like Figma, it doesn't mean that they can do better than someone else. It's just like something that they just spend more time doing and practicing, and that doesn't really add to a personal brand, I think.
That's 100% true. So you identified yourself as a connector, someone that likes to connect people. Mm-hmm. And you are leveraging that inherent ability of yours to launch a conference.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we know that, at least myself and a lot of other designers that I know, that designers are not necessarily the most extrovert people that you could find, right? How important is it, the topic of networking?
For design? I think it's super important no matter your personality type. Obviously, you know, I'm a little biased because I am an extrovert, but I think some of the best, you know, founders and people out there that are designers are more on the introvert side.
Right.
There was this funny thing happening at Config the other day where they had the stickers to put on the badge, and they had like stickers for introverts and stickers for extroverts, and the introverts ran out like immediately on day one. There were no more left. So obviously the majority is on this side. But I don't think that should stop people, because what happens is like not all networking and not all leveraging your network has to happen with like specifically social contact and putting yourself out there in types of events or things like that. I think there's a lot of work that one can do. For example, working in, again, right, on projects that are close to you and that you believe in and that you can do by yourself and, you know, sort of hatch for a very long time was just, you know, me just thinking about this in my office and putting together and talking to people. And there was really not a big out there moment where I had to go and be like, hey, everyone, conference, bye now, you know, until much later in the game. So I think the networking bit, a lot of people just think that it means just going to meetups and events and talking to 100 people and getting their business cards and things like that. And that's definitely not it. To me, networking has to do with making people see you and remember you after they met you or they talked to you. And you can achieve that more powerfully when you have something to show for yourself. Absolutely. Right? When you are like, hey, you're not just a guy I met on the street. You have a design studio and you do all of this interesting work and stuff like that. And this is what I'm going to remember about you. Not just that I talked to you 20 times in different bars, you know? And to me, it's like, yeah, eventually it's like, yeah, I run a design conference. I run design meetups and people actually kind of like, I'm happy to talk about them as well. And that doesn't mean that I have to talk about myself or my own, you know, personality or hobbies or things like that. So I think eventually it's the way to go. And for those people who are a little more on the introvert side, what I always say is like getting into projects and things that you care about, will break a lot of those like social anxieties, because it is much easier to talk about what you're doing and what you stand for than about yourself.
Wow. That's fascinating. Let me summarize to make sure I understood it correctly. So you're saying that networking is not necessarily about going from one event to another event, from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to like Saturday, and being in this bar or in the conferences with almost somewhat the same people. It's not about that. It's about getting involved in projects that are meaningful to you, that you could make an impact, and let your work speak for itself. Let your work present you out there, and let your work be the vehicle that other people remember you with.
Yeah, I mean, that's one strategy, and that's sort of what works for me, right? I think it can vary, but in general, yes, I think it's kind of something that you start on your own and your own security, and then you kind of like let go a little bit and you let that ball roll and just collect a lot more possibilities. Because, for example, one thing that the conference brought me is the possibility to just like have a lot of conversations on the excuse of like, I have a conference and let's, you know, that's how we met and that's how I met a ton of people. I'll just be like, hey, I want to see what you think about this, or do you want to speak about that, or, you know, send an email to Brad Frost and be like, hey, do you want to come to Berlin? Yeah. Kind of like, sure. Why would I do that? You know, I always think about this, like, if I wanted to like get in touch with him and kind of like be on his mind, it would have to be like months of like Twitter exchanges and things that I'm not good at all. But with this kind of other thing, it's like, hey, if there's a proposal, you obviously do this for a living, you know, it benefits us both. And like, let's just start a conversation. So it's this is just thanks to a little project that sort of led my network to grow in a way that I didn't have to go to events and I didn't have to like get a big microphone and speakers and scream at people.
That's so true. It resonates with me what you said so much, because, you know, we started this podcast about 5 months, 4 months ago, and 5 months ago, and seriously got behind it. Weekly episodes about 3 months ago, and I really didn't know. You know, sometimes in business, you have certain hypotheses or certain ideas in mind, and you have you have an understanding of what kind of impact could bring for your business. Mm-hmm. But when we wanted to start the podcasting, I had no idea. The only thing that really got me really excited was that, hey, I could have conversation with cool people. Mm-hmm. We could lock ourselves in a, you know, virtual room for like 45, 50, 60 minutes and just talk and like exchange knowledge and exchange experiences. That got me really excited. And it's still to this date, whenever I have a podcast date in a week, I'm really excited to have it, because it's becoming my moment of zen, my mm-hmm. space for just, because like I turn off all of my screens, flip my phone, and just like I'm with you and I'll be talking, we're going back and forth. So that was my initial curiosity and initial excitement about running a podcast. And it's a very like energy resource, like resource intensive production. Mm-hmm. We have a team of 4 people behind this. And long story short, you know, again, I was not planning for this. Out of this, you know, we did 2 collaboration. I got to meet you. I got to meet and a lot. I was in a 60-minute conversation with Jeff Goddard, Teresa mm-hmm. Torres, Jamie Levy, all these like idols that I read their books and I was really excited yeah. about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's priceless.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the other side of things, that when you have something that's more of a product, you always have to be thinking as well as like what's good for the audience. So you can't just be, I mean, you can be as lucky that you're sort of like, say like, hey, I start this thing because I really like to do it, and then people buy into it and then sort of becomes something else. For something like the conference, that's why, for example, I have the meetups on the conference, right? And the meetups are a lot more relaxed because they're free and they're open for everyone. And even if we make mistakes or suddenly a talk is not so interesting or whatever, what do you care? It's free. You didn't pay. You had a good time and had some beers, and you know, that's fine. For the conference, it's different because, you know, I'm trying to make the best possible experience. Yeah. I respect that people are paying good money for it, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to disappoint them. So I always like to go the extra mile. So there's this whole part that is really like the hard work that comes sometimes in a lot of uncomfortable places for oneself, to actually have to do things like that, you know, multiple little details. Like right now we're like thinking about, you know, the gift bag and things like that, and having all these discussions about like, is it really necessary, you know, sustainability wise doesn't really make sense, but we want people to keep something, but what could it be, you know, what makes sense, what's original, what's affordable, you know, all these kind of discussions that, I mean, you could just give them a cheap bag with a logo and stuff and people would not even mind, right? But we want to make this something that makes sense in kind of all little details and senses. And this is why I think that's where it really has to be a passion project, even if you're charging yeah. for it and even if you're doing it in this way.
Like, let's just say here, I would like to pick your mind on this topic that, you know, we live in the agile world, that is say, hey, no worries, don't forget about the perfection, let's just go forward, you know, let's just ship. But now you're talking to me about very detailed items in a conference that you are about to hold and trying to perfect those details. Like, as a designer, how do you navigate these two school of thought, being agile and anti-perfectionist, and also on the other side, being perfectionist and trying to get the details right for the total delivered experience?
I think as designers, we're mostly trained to be perfectionists, but as entrepreneurs, we're learned to let go of a lot of that perfectionism because we realize that the return on investment is not worth it, right? And this is, I think, having had in my career all those things like pushing against each other really allowed me to say, like, hey, you know what, I can take the time to really think this through, but I at the same time can eventually let go and be like, hey, you know what, this is not worth the time spent on this, let's just kill it. Or know that even if I try to control a lot of things that are going to happen there, a lot of things are going to go wrong, and then you're going to have to at the end of the day be like, hey, you know what? We had this really nice sign, like lit sign for the outdoors, but it's raining like crazy. We can't set it up. It's not going to happen. Kill it. And then you have to be fine with that. And this is one of the things that I think it's really hard for. I think most designers tend to be on the perfectionism side because we're sort of like taught, even like the idea of pixel perfection, which I never really understood and vouched for. But even this kind of ideas. Are seem to be like everywhere, but eventually, once you really have to spend a lot of time doing something that's not appreciated, then and you really start valuing your time and the overall experience of things like attendees in a conference, then you learn to let go of certain things that don't make sense. That being said, I believe that when you want to make the extra effort and have kind of like this golden standard for things, and you really want to put something out there that people remember, it is good to spend time thinking of some of these details, even if they end leading up nowhere.
I agree. Especially if you're in the service business, if you're in the experience business, I think the devil is always in the details.
And it can be very small things, right? Like last year we had breakfast at the conference, and we had just ordered hundreds of croissants, and then we realized, okay, there's like three people in the list that are gluten intolerant, so they basically are not going to be able to have this. So one of our members she went to a gluten free bakery just to get like the croissants, gluten free croissants for these three people who were not going to be able to eat the other croissants. And I mean, in a normal world, you'd be like, yeah, they cannot eat them. They know they cannot eat them. They probably prepare for that or ate something before. But they were so moved by the fact that when we received them, we had a gluten-free croissant for them, just especially, and we thought about this little detail, right? And it's something that took us like 15 minutes, maybe. But nonetheless, it makes an impression. And I think this is the kind of thing that we at Hatch stand for, and we want to like continue to have in terms of like that attention to detail and to those ideas. And then there's a lot of things that also can go wrong, even if you really plan for them, and then people forget about that as well.
You know, out of curiosity, and also I want to basically, I know that how much work you have, I don't know, but I can imagine a lot of work. Yes. But like for our audience, especially, you know, a lot of younger designers are listening, or maybe some of them have entrepreneurial background or the aspiration. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through how much work one should be putting into launching and, you know, launching a conference as good as Hatch Conference? How many hours you spend, how many people you're working with, like just give us an image behind how much work you have to put into it to be able to, on the front end, you see a pixel perfect conference.
Yeah, so the hard work that you have to put into it is way less than the work I put into it. It's just really like, it's just like, to me, it's such a passion project. And it's really like I'm not working full time for this, but I kind of am, because I'm all the time thinking about stuff and trying to solve stuff and trying to, you know, we're going over the bar just to make this like a very special thing. The general part about a conference is always like, you know, get the financing for making it happen. That means either sell enough tickets or have enough sponsors or both in the best case scenario, and you know, have your Excel sheet where like how much money are you gonna spend, how much money you get. does it leave you some money for after? Then great, then you have a conference, right? Everything else that comes after that has to do with a lot of scheduling and planning, and a lot of trust, because we're a very small team. So I'm working myself, then this guy called Alex, who's been helping me from last year, Alex Thurman. He now lives in Cologne. He used to live in Berlin. So we do everything remotely. And then we have Clemence Robert, who's like a designer living in Barcelona. She was MC last year, and she's also involved this year in a lot of the organization of the conference. But the amount of things that we have going on and the amounts of different touch points with everyone from like speakers to participants to sponsors, you know, providers and all that kind of stuff, it is really like it's an all day long task. The way I do it is exactly this discipline that we talked before. I'm very good at planning. I'm very good at like having those times right, and I also like to try a little over my comfort zone and see like, can we really achieve this? And is this really something that could work? And you know, that involves having a lot of conversations, most of them that go nowhere, with everything from providers, artists, sponsors, and stuff like that. And then I think with time you get a little more of a sense of how, you know, what could work, what doesn't, how to talk to certain people, how, you know, what this specific, value proposition is. And then it becomes a lot easier. Specifically on like what is the work, I think primarily because we're a little different in the way that we're invitation only and people have to apply first to be able to purchase a ticket. We wanted to be early enough you know, to not have to worry about like ticket sales on the very last month or something like that, and luckily it sold out in like 2 months or something like that.
Fantastic.
And what I did, I think what helped with that is from the very beginning, we had like four very strong speakers, people would pay money to go see live and online in Berlin, and obviously going with a very strong offer in that way. And obviously the fact that it happened last year and a lot of people enjoyed it and had nice things to say, you know, that really was, I think, what led everything to the rest just be production and planning and arrangement. And if you're not good at that other part, you can always outsource it, of course. But at the beginning, kind of how to do it all yourself.
Oh, so fantastic. So to get the core offering right, introduce a really competitive product out there, lock in the finances that you need to run the production. The production now is it's not an afterthought, but like, you know, this is basically secondary to the core offering.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, as any business, you should always start with the numbers. Like, no matter how great your idea is, if it's not feasible, you're just going to lose not only time but money. And this is not a great way to start a business. Like, if you feel that what you want to do, I mean, of course, it happens that my vision of the first one was much bigger, much more spectacular than what I could do with the budget that I had for the first one. But it doesn't matter, right? At a certain point, it is about getting it out there and sort of having like a longer term vision, and obviously these things just are really word of mouth. People really talk about their experiences in there and in events. People are looking for, you know, extraordinary experiences. So you have to deliver that and be that, you know, worth the money, worth the time, especially because as mostly companies pay for tickets for attendees. Like I would say, like 60% of tickets are paid by companies and not by the attendees themselves. Eventually, it's more about the time of the people, right? If they really feel like they want to stay, because it's not about selling the tickets. It's about actually people staying 12, 13 hours in a place with other people.
That's a good point. You're not only selling to the person that attends, you're selling to the chief financial officer or like the chief design officer or HR, because they have to basically approve it. That's one. And second is that it's not only attending and listening to talks, they're staying there for 13 hours, 12 hours. It's about designing an experience that could could, I wouldn't use, I mean, I don't want to use the term entertain, but at least, you know, make sure that they wouldn't feel bored or, you know, they don't know what to do for 13 hours in that environment.
Yeah. And I think that's key, right? Like most of us, you know, especially when you work in tech, have a good enough salary, you're not going to be like, oh, you know, I pay like 150, 200 euros to be here. And then, you know, I might as well stay because I paid for it. Like, you don't care. You're just like, yeah, if this is a terrible event, I'm going to leave. So I think obviously for events, it's quite simple and quite complex at the same time. People have to be comfortable. People have to be well fed, mm-hmm. not thirsty. They have mm-hmm. to be entertained, but they also have to be able to, like, you know, find their own spaces. Mm-hmm. And yeah, some people will eventually, you know, get tired and leave. That's part also of like how yeah. people work and your mood that day. And if you have children waiting for you in the evening or something like that. But in general, it's about creating a comfortable enough space that also is something to remember, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's, time flies, 54 minutes in.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's just beautiful, like organic conversation. That's what I wanted for a Friday afternoon. Damien, last topic and closing topic is, you are in the trenches. You were recently at FitMonk Conf, and this year has been a renaissance for the creative world, AI, ChatGPT, Midjourney, Diagram, Figma is getting revamp, what have you. Mm-hmm. How do you see the role of AI in UX design, specifically in creativity, secondary? How do you think it impacts the job market? And sort of like, if you want to like have a face-to-face and one-on-one with our UX design audience that are listening to this podcast, what kind of, you know, insights would you like to share?
Obviously, it's very early to know a lot of the answers for all of these things, just because it's happened so fast. I mean, when we started even planning the conference this year, AI wasn't even much of a topic, right? We didn't even really think that we were going to have any type. And now it's like, I don't know, like 20% of the conference is around AI. Yeah, and that could, it could be more. Maybe it's going to be more. We just have to all be kind of paying attention to what happens. I think that you can really differentiate between like the generative stuff and the kind of more like assistive stuff. I'm particularly not too excited about the generative quite yet, because I feel we kind of get used to the outputs and it's not something that we can work with too much at this point. This is maybe more interesting for non-designers that get into design. But everything that has to do with assistive, with like automating and taking care of all the stuff that we're repeating over and over, generating assets, you know, there's, for example, I just saw like the preview of the AI product for Corebook, who is a brand guidelines, online brand guidelines tool. And basically when you generate brand guidelines, you're doing the same thing over and over again and yeah. creating the same pages and the same, like, it doesn't make sense that we do this manually. This is not good use of our time. So when AI can just like get my variables, get my, you know, my paddings and my logos and stuff and just create everything for me, this is just like, yes, this is what something that a designer should not be doing anymore. And this is what particularly I'm excited about. And this is particularly what I'm like, yeah, people will stop doing that, but doesn't mean that their jobs will be lost. It's more like they will have time to do other stuff. Potentially, yeah. AI will kill the very, very bottom of the barrel kind of Fiverr designer, right? At one point, when AI can generate you like a decent looking logo instead of just paying yeah. $20 to someone on Fiverr, that person might lose their job. But in the strategic part or in the broader part, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm with you on this. I think AI is going to rock the bottom line for sure. Mm-hmm. That's you know, rock the bottom line, not only for the creative industry, for all the industries that are in the soft knowledge business. Mm-hmm. Machinery, this is different beast that I don't know so much anything about. I don't want to talk about it because I don't know anything mm-hmm. about it. But I think in the soft knowledge industries, is going to rock the bottom line across the board. But I don't think if you're a strategic designer, you should be worried about it, because the process of finding problems and like addressing them and looking into business model, how you could like really like come up with initiatives on the design fronts to improve the organization business model, revenue stream, that's something that AI is far from addressing.
And we're in an industry that's so much about the people that I would say it's really hard that a lot of the dynamics get replaced, because even if a computer might be able to do it, we're still always going to prefer certain things, right? So at a certain point, I thought about this as well, right? Like, what's going to be a conference when like AI is just like everywhere? And then it's just going to be like, well, then people are going to actually want to go and talk to each other about, you know, how terrible they're feeling about it or something. So it's still valid, I guess.
Hey, I really appreciated to come on the podcast, have this amazing conversation with me. Thanks a lot and have a fantastic Friday.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more information, go to bonanza-studios.com.